Back with more of my conversation with inventor Aaron Murakami and your phone calls when Coast to Coast AM continues right after this. Aaron Murakami stays with us, inventor. And Aaron, I'm getting all sorts of emails. People want to know, how can I buy a plasma ignition system? I mean, I know you have a patent on it, but is it commercially available?
It's not commercially available. Most people are learning about it in the books and videos at ignitionsecrets.com, and then they can buy off-the-shelf parts, for example, an off-the-shelf capacitive discharge unit, and they can just buy the diodes and the right kind of ignition coil, but they'll have to put it together themselves. It'd probably be recommended for somebody who has at least some basic mechanical skills. They don't really have to know very much about electronics, because most of the complicated electronics are already in the performance ignition module, so they don't even have to build that. They just get the parts, put them together as shown in the diagram, and they can either build a bench model. The older the car, the easier it is to put on a car.
Right, because you don't have to bypass the computer. And for example, with a lawnmower, from what I understand, it used to be that you could adjust the fuel mixture, so you could really lean it out, and you could put one of these, you could put, for example, your plasma ignition system on a lawnmower. But I understand now you can't even buy a new lawnmower. There's no valve there to adjust the fuel mixture.
Correct, and that's the EPA is limiting that. Just like the gas generator I have, the EPA won't let them sell the generators with adjustable carburetors. The company did send me some high-altitude jets, which are leaner, but I am going to move in the direction of having it fully adjustable by doing some modifications and maybe using like a go-kart carburetor or something.
Okay, so talk about the plasma ignition system that you put on your jet engine that I saw in your backyard. It's running on propane.
Yeah, traces of propane. So basically, it is a propane-powered jet engine. I built a jet engine out of a turbocharger off of a car, created the combustion chamber and a very efficient flame tube inside. The thrust comes out, it boils water. The water vapor, in turn, goes back into the intake, and the plasma ignition stays on. Typically in a jet engine, when the flame tube gets hot enough, you turn the igniter off, and the fuel will just self-ignite from that heat. But I leave the plasma ignition on because any of the moisture coming in there is just going to get instantly dissociated. Before I did a lot of the modifications on the jet engine, with the fuel nozzle, came off of an oil burner in a like a regular home heating system. And that's what I'm putting the propane through. And before we did a lot of the modifications, it took 8 pounds per square inch just to be able to idle that jet engine. By the time I was done, I can turn the propane down to where the needle is practically sitting on zero, because it's using such a small amount of propane, we can't even measure it.
And that was that on full throttle?
When
it was near zero?
That's actually turned down quite a bit. That's at the bare minimum speed. You know, if I crank it open and turn it up, it'll run so fast and hot that it will, make the exhaust housing on that turbo glow red hot. But with the nitrogen process and moving in the direction of what Stanmeyer was doing, it's that type of chemistry is really very slow, and so you want to actually have a jet engine that runs very slow. But the efficiency of the jet is so incredible that I can put my hand about 2 to 3 feet from the thrust, and it's so cool I can just indefinitely keep my hand there.
Okay, so just to summarize, so normally you're using about 8 pounds per 8 PSI
just to idle
this jet engine.
Yes.
When you incorporate your plasma ignition system, now it's an analog meter, so we can't be too precise, but I was there, I saw it. It was the needle was around zero.
Yes.
Okay, so that's obviously pretty disruptive.
Yeah, it's a high 90%, reduction in the amount of fuel just to run that.
Right. And what are some of the applications for this jet engine?
There are gas turbine generators where there is like a form of a jet engine, which is basically powering a generator to produce electricity.
Right.
I would really go with the regular gas generator sets because they're easier to deal with. That I was following the path of somebody who had a water-powered jet engine, somebody who knew Stan Meyer, and Meyer admitted that his fuel process was an ammonia process, and that's who I learned a jet engine from. And I can bring the propane down where the needle is practically sitting on zero, and I'm not even done with it yet. I'm not even modifying the fuel Yeah, this is just with the plasma and just by recycling the exhaust back to the intake. So
Now,
that's
you
done.
have a patent on this, but you're open sourcing this. You want to share this with the world, right?
Yeah, it is patented, but I give everybody permission to, use it for personal use and to learn because I want people to be able to understand this. Because not only is the technology potentially disruptive for the purposes of greatly reducing fuel, but the concepts within that circuit, as far as being able to reduce or eliminate the resistance on an electrical circuit, those kind of things are thought to be impossible. So it's also disruptive in the sense of, what academics are saying is possible. And I'm doing it with, a couple hundred bucks worth of off-the-shelf parts and
Well, I was
no.
kind of joking. I was joking. Is it time to repeal the second law of thermodynamics? And you have a real sort of bee in your bonnet about sort of the orthodox scientific community and how we are locked into this idea of, within a closed system, and how these laws of thermodynamics operate. And you're trying to tell everybody, listen, this is not woo-woo. Free energy, perpetual motion stuff. This all falls within the laws of thermodynamics.
Yes, and I would say it actually has been repealed, but the academics haven't got the note yet.
They didn't get the memo.
Right. I mean, see, back in see, in 1977, Ilya Prigogine, a Russian chemist and thermodynamicist, received a Nobel Prize for his work on open dissipative systems or open thermodynamics. And it was basically said that it extended the field of thermodynamics to include systems that can produce more than what the operator has to put in. But in reality, it actually corrected thermodynamics because the second law of thermodynamics is taught actually doesn't apply to anything in the universe. There are no closed systems. All
That's
systems are
true.
open,
Right.
but there are open systems that are not designed to make use of environmental input, and there's open systems that are designed to make use of environmental input.
I
And
believe
so
this was the example you gave me, and I thought it was quite succinct and
with the
very
kite,
the kite.
yeah.
Explain how for example, a person flying a kite really sort of it illustrates what you're saying about, there is no such thing as a closed system, and you can have more sort of output than input.
Yeah, and the distinction is that it's not really more out is going in. It's more out is there's more going out than what the operator has to put in, which implies that there has to be extra input from the environment somewhere. Conventionally, it's only believed that can only happen with heat pumps, but it can happen with mechanical systems and electrical systems and other kind of systems. So, let's say there's a child running out in the park and he's going to fly a kite, and let's say he gets the kite up in the air. He could technically, if there's enough wind blowing, tie it off on a bench, walk away, and it'll continue to fly. So let's just say that this kid, runs, gets the kite up into the air, and for a certain period of time, let's say he puts in 1 unit of energy. That's it, 1 unit of energy. And let's say over that period of time, free wind contributes 9 parts energy into flying that kite. But let's say it has a bad kite design, everything is going against this kid, and let's just say half of all the input is completely chewed up in losses. So if the kid puts in one and wind puts in one, that's a total input of 10 parts of work. If half of it got lost in losses with bad kite design and friction and whatever else, that means only 5 units of work actually went to flying the kite. So the total input is 10. 5 parts of intended work were done. That's a 50% efficient, which is horrible. Cars are 20-something percent, so that's, better than a car, better than a solar panel, which are in the low 20s. But so that's 50% efficient. However, 5 units of work were done, but the child only had to contribute one. That means that child just got a 500% net gain in work that he didn't have to pay for. He put in one and wound up with 5 units of work of flying. And that's because what he did was leverage free environmental input with his open system so that free input can come in and doesn't prevent entropy, but it delays it. So as long as the wind is coming in, that's extending the time that it takes to come to entropy, which means a lot more work can be done than what he has to pay for. So it's not more out than in, it's more out than what the operator puts in, and that's the distinction that both the skeptics and unfortunately a lot of people in the so-called free energy world does not understand that distinction. So when
In other words, that's the entropy, that's the second law. And because they're closed system, they don't acknowledge environmental inputs like the wind beneath the kite. Another example from nature you pointed out, a very simple one, is just, you plant a seed in the garden. Look at the energy that springs. There's an old saying, even an oak tree starts out as a nut.
Right, you
So,
walk out into the yard and you plant a seed in the ground and walk away, come back 10 years later, you're going to have a tree producing nuts and all millions and millions and millions of times more work were done than what you had to contribute. And over time, the longer that time goes on and is going to be more input from the environment, the heat, from the soil, from the sun, the nutrients, water, all those contributions don't even come from you. And over time, that dwarfs your input more and more and more.
then why are they so resistant? They being, I don't know, the people with the letters behind their name.
Well, it completely violates, I think, what they believe. They're always talking about you can only get out what you put into it, and I do not know why the these open system thermodynamics are not acknowledged in energy systems, really. But if you search, open system thermodynamics or open dissipative systems actually are embraced at the upper university level in different fields of, everything from sociology to economics. When people come together to create a community, that's like a self-organizing process that kind of comes together. It's accepted in biology, how cells can kind of self-organize, because if you have a self-organizing principle, in a way that's different things kind of coming together instead of dissipating outwards. It's a collection or a coming together, which is kind of a reverse entropy type process. But as soon as you start talking about open system thermodynamics or open dissipative systems in connection with energy systems that are not heat systems, suddenly it's a big taboo.
All right, let's go to the phones. And west of the Rockies, Patrick is calling from, there's your synchronicity again, Spokane, Washington. Patrick, good morning. Welcome to Coast. Patrick, are you there? We lost Patrick. All right, perhaps he'll call back. Let's say hi to, is it Mike in Illinois? Mike in
Hello, Richard.
Illinois. Hi, Mike, go ahead.
Hey, Aaron, I was wanting to ask if you'd ever seen this technology that I saw on TV probably about 15, 17 years or so ago. Are you familiar with how an ionic breeze works,
Yes.
an air purifier? Well, these guys had this spec home. It was about 2,000 square feet, and they had this big box next to the house, and they said that it was loaded with plates of varying metallic material. And like one plate would be one material, and then another material, and then the next plate would be the same as the first. But through atmospheric pressure, the ambient air would pass between all these plates, and through the breaking of the covalent bonds from a slight charge that ran through these plates, that they could collect that energy released from the molecules breaking apart, and that this device collected way more energy than the house ever used, and they were selling energy back to the grid. And I had been looking on the internet. I've scoured the internet for years now looking for that technology, and just recently I ran across something that said that, well, that wasn't an actual technology that had came to fruition yet. And I couldn't find that program again. It's like it just disappeared.
I have not personally heard of that. I understand the principle you're mentioning. That sounds interesting and actually kind of makes sense. But I have never heard anybody utilizing that principle at a large scale to produce power like that.
Yeah, they said that it was completely free energy once the device was built. They said that it's just a trickle of energy to get it started, and then the energy that it gathered kept it going and also created energy basically out of thin air,
Yeah, well, these high voltage processes, and when you start getting into electrostatics versus current-driven type technologies, there's a lot of electrostatic type technologies that do not always necessarily conform to what conventional believers would consider to be. Basically, it violates second law of thermodynamics, and there are different electrostatic generators, and I know people who have worked on different electrostatic type technologies, but yeah, nothing like what you're describing. But I do understand the principle of what you're talking about.
All right, Mike in Chatham, Illinois. Thank you for that. We had a caller that dropped off, and Aaron, they wanted to know whether the plasma ignition system would work on a diesel engine as well.
Actually, yes. This ignition is so strong that people have run gas generators on diesel. Not on a diesel engine, but on a gas generator. They're using diesel with this plasma ignition. And this plasma ignition is actually so strong, it'll even start ethanol in sub-freezing temperatures.
All right. West of the Rockies, Wayne is in Lakewood, Washington. Wayne, good morning. Welcome to Coast.
And good evening, gentlemen. Aaron, I was trying to do something that I guess you've already done 40 years ago. I had a 1966 Delta 88, about a 18, 19 foot long.
You could maybe speak up a little bit.
3,000.
Yeah, we'll get you to speak up, Wayne.
Sure, I'll speak up. About a 10 and a half car. It had the 425 high performance engine and its standard horsepower was about 350. So normally it would only get about 68 miles to gallon around town, maybe 12, 14 on the freeway. And I thought that was terrible. And so I looked into all the different things I could do to make it perform better. The first thing I did was lubricants. I used graphite motor oil and put in about a tablespoon of molybdenum disulfide. And for the audience that doesn't know what that is, it's looks like graphite, but if you look at it under a microscope, it's like a super round, hard ball bearings. And it's ground to a very fine consistency. So in graphite motor oil, it kept that in suspension, and it lubricated up the motor real well. Then I took the quad carburetor and blocked off the secondary or the main portion of the carburetor and just ran off the little two primary intake up front to give smaller fuel. And, you know, normally you would think, well, that's going to greatly reduce the horsepower. I'm sure it did reduce the horsepower somewhat, but it still ran good. And then for spark ignition, I used a very high-performance spark coil. You solder collet wires to each spark plug, and then I used the only platinum plugs that were available at the time, which I think were the Bosch single injection plugs. And with that system, I was able to get greatly increased, performance on its own. And then on top of that, I took it in and had a Dynatune for economy on a Dynatuner with a, you know.
How much gas, how did you improve the gas mileage, Wayne, from 6 to 8 miles in the city?
I didn't do great tests around the city, but I ran a test like from Portland, Oregon up to Tacoma, Washington and back. And I filled it up to the, where it's coming out of the hole to go up. When I got up to Tacoma, turning around, I did the same thing coming back.
Okay, I got to move along, Wayne. Listen, it sounds like you did an interesting little modification there. We'll continue our conversation with Aaron Murakami, the plasma ignition system. We'll get back to our conversation with Aaron Murakami and the plasma ignition system in just a moment, and your phone calls. Just a reminder that you can listen to my weekly syndicated radio program, The Conspiracy Show, live on Zoomer Radio right here in Toronto or on one of our growing list of affiliates across North America. Just go to strangeplanet.ca for more information, strangeplanet.ca, or you can download the free Conspiracy Show app and listen anytime, anywhere. Back again with Aaron Murakami in mere moments right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. Richard Serrett coming to you live from Coast's Toronto affiliate talk radio AM 640. Aaron Murakami, inventor, on the line. And Aaron, tell me about this annual conference, this Energy Science and Technology Conference that you organize sort of in the, I guess it's in Idaho, but it's very close to Spokane.
Yeah, this will be about my fifth conference that I put together. It's in Hayden, Idaho, which is about maybe a 50-minute drive from the Spokane Airport. And every year, about 150 people fly in from all over the world to listen to our presenters. We have I present there myself, but we have people like John Bedini, Peter Lindemann, Eric Dollard, Paul Babcock, Jim Murray, William Lyon has presented there. So a lot of the, big names that people have been following for a lot of years in the so-called free energy and Tesla science field. There's usually about maybe 12 or 13 presentations over the weekend. It's a 3-day event, And people can, anybody can find out more information about that on energyscienceconference.com. There's only about 33 seats available. We're way ahead of schedule this year. When people find out that people like, you know, John Bedini and these kind of people are going to be there, the registrations go pretty quick, because a lot of people really want to talk to these people. They stay kind of low profile, but they're the ones who are, you know, proven over many decades, because they show technologies that work and, you know, that conform to these open system concepts that are the real free energy machines. And these are the kind of things that we're able to show at the conference. It's pretty much the only energy conference you'll go to where you actually see these so-called over-united machines actually working.
That's a term I heard over and over again when I was in Spokane from yourself and Peter Lindemann, who I met also, and Paul Babcock. I kept hearing this over-unity. Can you just give us a quick explanation as to what that means?
Yeah, basically is a machine that's producing more than what you put into it. It's another term for free energy. Over-unity is kind of means more than everything that you have within that system. So it's kind of not really a proper term, but the term has stuck so long that is understood what it means. You know, actually, a lot of these people, they do not like the term over-unity or free energy because of a lot of the misunderstandings behind it. But, you know,
sure, it carries a lot of baggage with it. Do you have detractors and skeptics who come to the conference and are trying to maybe, I don't know, poke holes or catch someone? Do they come?
There are some people who have a little bit of skepticism there, but surprisingly, everybody is very respectful. It's always a pretty laid-back, casual atmosphere. You know, we have everybody from the layman all the way up to college professors, you know, coming in from all over the world. Most people from U.S. and Canada and about every other country I've ever heard of. But nobody has really, you know, stood up to start yelling at anybody up on stage or throwing rotten apples or anything like that. And so we've been.
And again, the conference is July 8th, 9th, and 10th?
Yeah, July 8th, 9th, and 10th. It's the first weekend after the 4th of July. And again, energyscienceconference.com has those details, and seats are running out. But the place where we have it is not super big. So when we say we can only take 150 people, we really mean it.
Well, maybe you need to expand the venue. You ever thought of that?
We have one of the benefits of keeping it kind of small like this is that it's more manageable, but it also gives a lot of the people flying in a good opportunity to really spend quality time with a lot of the people that they've always wanted to meet, and to be able to approach the speakers and ask questions and sit down and have a drink with them, and, you know, see that they're, you know, regular laid back, you know, people like everybody else. And so that time there is, you know, just as important as the presentations.
Right. It's all about networking as well.
Absolutely.
East of the Rockies, and Gregory is a trucker on the Jersey Turnpike. Gregory, you still with us? Are you still there, Greg? We lost Gregory. Wild card line. Tom is in Lecanto, Florida. Tom, good morning. Welcome
hello,
to Coach.
Hello, Richard. Good evening.
Hi.
And hello to Aaron. Very interesting show. Aaron, I wonder if you could give us some more details on your design. For example, are the diodes low-threshold Schottky diodes? What is the peak inverse voltage rating? And have you considered using an SCR, a silicon-controlled rectifier, to control the conduction angle?
I was going to ask you that.
I have not used SCRs. These diodes are similar to ham radio diodes. In the past, these are about 20,000 volts, 2 amps. Seems to work pretty good. These kind of diodes used to be, you know, $20-$30 a piece, but shopping
was that,
around.
Was that from a K2AV supplier?
No, this is on eBay. I'm pretty sure they're coming out of China or something, but I've been able to get these 20,000 volt, 2 amp high voltage diodes for about $2 a piece.
Okay, but typically they're rated at 1,000 volts. You have to put equalizing resistors in a string, right?
No, I just, it's all built into one package. I got the anode, I got the cathode, and I just hook it up in the right direction depending on the high voltage polarity. If it's positive high voltage output or negative high voltage output on the ignition coil, that will determine which direction I point the diode. But it's really just one big diode, and I don't have to add anything else.
Okay. Tom, thank you for the call. I appreciate that. I don't want to get too arcane because my head's going to explode. Good questions all, though, Tom. Thank you for that. First-time caller, Mike is... Oh, no, we lost the first-time caller. Eric is in Fairfield, Ohio. Eric, good morning. Welcome to Coast.
Hey, how How you doing, Richard?
Very well, thank you.
Long time listener. I had a question for Aaron about the plasma ignition systems.
Sure.
I heard you say something about it'd be better if you had older model vehicles and that kind of thing. I actually have a 79 Yamaha 1100 and an 81 Yamaha 1100. And there's like four carbs for each cylinder, and you can adjust the richness in the fuel and mm-hmm. or back it off or whatever on each carb. I mean, is that something you could actually put on a motorcycle, or have you tried putting them on motorcycles?
I have not tried putting it on motorcycles. What I'm trying to do is get a simple diagram to the common CDIs that are, you know, pretty much a dime a dozen for bikes to see if we can utilize that. But long story short, no, I've never used it on a motorcycle. I've been approached by many people who are into motorcycle racing and they want to do this, at least not with the setup that I have. There is another variation of the circuit that would be easier to put on a motorcycle. Depends on if you have the power source to be able to charge the capacitor up. Some of the ratings for the capacitors I've seen in some of these motorcycle CDIs are, you know, like a fraction of a microfarad, and it's not really enough to really give the plasma effect. And so if there's some way that you can power a, you know, a capacitor in one of these CDIs, capacitive discharge ignition module, or an MSD, multiple spark discharge module, if there is one that you can find that you can put on your bike where it'll power the power supply for it, then yes, you can put it on a bike.
I mean, it already gets great gas mileage, but I'm figuring it could even do a lot better.
Sure, yeah, you'd be able to lean it out, and actually you can even drop the temperature, too.
Right.
Eric, thank you for that. Your book, Aaron, Ignition Secrets, how do people get a hold of that?
Yeah, Ignition Secrets is on ignitionsecrets.com. It's actually a package of three big files that contain quite a few hours of video. There's an hour or so video presentation from a conference a couple years ago in addition to a book. And there's a whole catalog of these books and videos at emediapress.com. So Ignition Secrets is on the Ignition Water Fuel Secrets, or you can go to waterfuelsecrets.com. That highlights the information about the nitrogen process on the water fuel. And if anybody wants to know about the thermodynamics and really look, you know, anybody can understand that kite flying analogy. Even, you know, even a child can understand it, that child just got a 500% net gain. All the real free energy technologies conform to those concepts, so it's not woo, you know, any magical, mystical woo-woo stuff. You know, it's real. And that's all highlighted in my book called The Quantum Key. And actually about a week ago, I did a two-hour whiteboard presentation as an added kind of tutorial to kind of walk people through the concepts to make it easier for them to understand. But if you want the book to have for, you know, so-called Free Energy 101 to walk you, you know, from A to Z, my unified field model is in there that uses mostly layman terms and elementary math and junior high school equations where almost anybody can understand the reality of what these open system thermodynamics is and how none of it violates any laws of physics whatsoever. And that's the quantum key, and that's listed on emediapress.com as well.
And are people around the country then, you know, because you're open sourcing this, are they finding out this information, building their own ignition systems, and then installing them on whatever, lawnmowers, generators, dirt bikes, and then emailing you back to tell you what kind of fuel efficiency and so forth they're getting?
Yeah, a small percentage of people have contacted me, and actually Peter Lindemann and I did put the plasma ignition on a lawnmower, and we screwed the primary gas jet all the way in, so no fuel was coming from that, and it was running on the idle jet, and we could wrap it out to full RPM, and the temperature dropped. And
just by opening the or keeping the idle jet open.
Yeah, it was only running on the idle jet, and we were able to get full RPM plus a temperature drop in the engine with the plasma ignition on a lawnmower.
So then they hide behind the EPA and say we need to remove the valve to allow people to mess with the fuel mixture. They're saying it's because of, you know, concerns for air pollution and so forth. But really, I mean, is this in your mind a clear example of, you know, the suppression of this type of technology?
Yeah, I think the EPA is just rubber stamping, you know, organization for the automobile and, you know, oil industry.
All right, let's go west of the Rockies. Jim is in Marysville, Washington. Jim, welcome to Coast to Coast. How are you?
I got a couple of questions.
Sure.
Number one is that this propulsion system going to allow us go to the stars and the planets in a reasonable amount of time? And secondly, does that mean that there's free energy available to our homes right now? I'll just take my answer on the air.
As far as a propulsion system, I'm not working on a propulsion system. However, this type of plasma ignition system is similar to some of the plasma thrusters used in developed by NASA, but it's using a consumable material. But actually, this plasma ignition effect is similar to some of that thruster technology. As far as a real propulsion system, take us to the stars, you know, you're dealing with having to get around quite a few barriers as far as inertia and that kind of thing, which actually I do address that in the Quantum Key on how to get around inertia. But your other question, as far as are there free energy technologies right now, not to get the home off the grid, most of the real so-called free energy technologies are more small scale and in developmental stages, but completely proven. We've even shown some of these at the conference. You know, I mean, for example, last year, an interesting one, you know, John Bedini showed one of his old machines known as a Cromray generator or a G gravity field generator. And as it's running on a battery, he hooks a light bulb up to it. And so when you start pulling a load from it, it actually speeded up instead of bogging down. And it started blowing cold air, and it cooled down instead of heating up. You know, that's kind of interesting. And the other, you know, motor, I mean, 6-7 years ago at another conference, Bedini showed a big 14-foot diameter wheel spinning, running on three 12-volt batteries for a 36-volt battery bank. And during the entire conference, it kept the battery bank on the backside fully charged up, where it was recovering all the electromagnetic energy, and the front battery never dropped one fraction of a volt.
We really don't have a clue about electricity, do we?
Conventionally, no. I do have a model of electricity in the Quantum Key. When you start looking into, you know, what a dipole is in separating the potential difference of the ether. You know, for example, I do believe in the ether. It has never been disproven. And if anybody wants to look at the reality of that and see the real history, they should really study the work of Dayton Miller, who did prove that there was an ether, and Einstein knew it. And you know, so this energy, you know, if you have a light bulb hooked to a battery, that battery is not even powering that light bulb. That battery, when it's charged, is not being filled up with something. You're just separating the internal charges of the chemistry to create a high, a positive on one end and a negative on the other end. And when that battery is sitting inside of space, what it's doing is it's polarizing the ether at the location of its terminals so that the positive potential of the ether moves towards the terminal of the battery, flows over the wire, through past the light bulb, and back to ground. And what that does, since it's positively charged, that flow moving over the wire, aka known as the heaviside flow, which is basically condensed polarized ether moving over the surface of the wire, the electrons in the wire are kicked out and are moving in the opposite direction towards the positive terminal, and that's where the current is coming from, is the electrons in the wire, not from the battery. And so that's the basic manifestation of electricity in a so-called closed circuit. And so that source potential is coming from the ether, and when the electrolyte in the battery gets scattered or disorganized, that's why the voltage starts dropping down, not because the battery ran out of anything, but because the polarized electrolyte in the battery to create that potential difference inside of the ether is becoming equalized.
East of the Rockies, Ben in Manchester, New Hampshire. You'll have to make it a quick one. Ben, you'll be our last call. Go ahead.
Okay, then. Thank you for being on it, and thank you very much for having this particular guest. We go to a lot of car shows. I'm in my late 50s and all that, but every once in a while we come across guys like this, and it's always cool to see that. I don't know how old the guest is, but he reminds me of all the young ones that are out there and the young blood coming in. And many years ago, back when E85 and all that crap fuel would come out, my information usually came from Hot Rod magazine. And they said because of the BTUs and because of the low grade, it really, you don't get the bang for the buck. And when ethanol came out, we all said, well, this stuff is going to ruin everything. And sure enough, it did. And yesterday, we were just talking about how it is and how the EPA itself, or at least whoever's in control, is saying, gee, you know, corn is going up and all this. And this fuel may not be you know, the magic bullet, and it's been forced down everyone's throat. So all I'm calling to say is thank you, and I hope a lot of people go to your conferences, because that's how they all get lit up themselves, by input and there's no substitute for the internal combustion motor. Until we learn how to ride on a light wave, that's what's going to power my 65 Coronet.
All right, Ben, thank you for that. A 65 Coronet. God bless you. All right. Aaron, again, the details for the Energy Science and Technology Conference.
So it's on July 8, 9, and 10 in Hayden, Idaho. All details are at energysscienceconference.com. And we're running out of seats. There are about 33 seats left out of 150. We've got about 2 months to go. So if you want to go ahead and register and submit your payment, and you'll definitely guarantee your seat, and you get to come meet all of us, see that we're, you know, very, very real and authentic, and we're dealing with some really, some authentic technologies, and you're going to see that the claims being made about a lot of these things are indeed, these machines do what we say that they do.
Aaron, thank you so much for this.
Thank you, Richard.
Aaron Murakami. For George Norrie, George Knapp, Lisa Lyons, Stephanie Smith, Tom Danheiser, Dan Galante, Sean Latasor, Jeff Duray, G. Lee, Happy Trails, Donna Walker, welcome aboard. And here in Toronto, Nathan Smith, Scott Guest, and Jackie Lamport, I'm Richard Serrett. Thank you for your ears and your voices, your beautiful voices. So long for now.